Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. This is episode 51, and to get you guys in the holiday spirit, Jim and I are talking today about the history of Christmas at the Disney resorts. In order to tell that story, of course, we need the jolly old man himself, and I mean Jim Hill. How's it going, Jim?
Ho, ho, ho.
So, Jim, it's early December. And that means, of course, that we celebrate the origins of some Scandinavian mythology that involves an old man in a red suit and some flying reindeer.
That we do. So
nothing says Christmas like Disney, right?
Well, not initially. Think about it. You know, Disneyland opens July of 1955.
America is still celebrating Christmas in the 1950s. I totally understand that.
Yes, but at the same time, it was a much more modest holiday. I mean, again, think about it. We're still outside of the early 1960s. You know, the whole notion of a holiday special, I mean, the Peanuts,
right.
You know, the first holiday special didn't air till 64, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and that was part of a GE theater show, and the one that really sort of, you know, that was one sort of kicked open the door, and the very next year was a Charlie Brown Christmas, and Christmas in America began sort of transforming during that period, you know, just sort of, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s just got bigger and bigger and bigger, but it was still a relatively small holiday at that point. I mean, you know, you can still, if, you know, you read the magazines and, you know, watch the shows of the period, there were even people back then who were bitching about, you know, oh, the commercialization of Christmas. The lights went up 10 days before the can't Christmas be on Christmas?
I've been going through the old Newhart, the original Newhart show. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, there were episodes that were, you know, 2 weeks before Christmas that literally didn't even mention winter.
Yeah.
Let alone the holiday. We contrast that with this year. I don't know if you saw the TV schedule, but Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer showed up on television the day before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
It's a special place in hell for people who schedule that, right?
It actually did better this year than it did last year. I mean, it did. And the weird thing is, you know, who's watching this? We all either own it on VHS or Blu-ray at this point.
Who hasn't memorized it, right?
But that's the thing. It's just everyone, oh, got to sit down with the family and watch Rudolph, you know, and cry.
It's the Peanuts Christmas special.
I don't know. It's always the last 5 minutes of Rudolph that undoes me, that the island of Misfit Toys. It's like, I know he's showing up. I know it.
That's good. Anyway. All right, so back in the 50s, a simpler time.
Similar time.
All right. So Disneyland opens in 55 in July.
Yeah. And look, Walt knew it was a hit over the summer months and when the kids were out of school. But again, you got to remember that, you know, fall and the early winter months were a huge question mark, especially during that first year of operation. And, you know, that coupled with the fact that people tend to forget that when Disneyland opened up, it got miserable press because of, you know, that overcrowded party where the people had printed up the faux invitations and people climbing over the back fence. And, you know, it was 3 years of Walt inviting reporters back before the reputation of the park turned around with the media. I mean, on the other hand, with the public, they loved the place right out of the get-go. And, mm-hmm. and when you think about that, Disneyland saw its 1 millionth visitor on September 8th, 55. That's just 53 days after the place opened.
Wow.
Those are some amazingly strong attendance numbers, again, given the poisonous press that it had for that opening. But anyway, you head into the fall months, and now it's like, all right, how do we properly staff the park? What hours should we be open?
Yeah, all this is unknown, right? Nobody's ever done an amusement park of this scale, right, year-round.
And they were 3 years in before they finally figured out that during spring and fall, what they do is they'd actually close the park on Mondays and Tuesdays. I mean, from 1958 to 1985, if you want to know, that's actually – if you've seen – Vacation, the movie with Chevy Chase, that's what that actually keys off of. There's a...
Right. Because they get to Wally World and it's closed.
Yeah, this great Doug... Oh, man, I'm blanking his name, but wrote for National Lampoon. But, you know, the Family Vacation 1962 that again ends with going to Disneyland and it's closed for the day, and ends up, you know, the dad goes to Disney's house and shoots him in the butt. So it's a wonderful holiday reading, folks. Check it out. Anyway, so it's fall of 55. Walt is concerned about what's going to happen for the holidays, because, again, it's just, can we actually get people to come out during the colder time of year? So what he decides to do is he's going to hold a circus. And in fact, in November 20th.
A circus.
You know, the, not only that, it's the Mickey Mouse Club Circus. This was presented, if you know the layout of the park, kind of where Small World is now, there were two giant tents. In fact, the biggest tent, and by the way, I got this information from Sam Genoway's brand new great history book of Disneyland, The Disneyland Story, which published by Keen Communications. Isn't that the company that publishes the unofficial guideline?
It is, in fact. What an odd coincidence.
That's startling. Huh. Anyway, this one-hour-long show was personally produced by Walt Disney, or so says Sam, to introduce the Mouseketeers to the general public. And I know this is what Sam is saying is true. I've seen the press release, which what cracks me up about this is that, you know, the Mickey Mouse TV show debuted on October 3rd, 1955, but here they are, you know, November, you know, hey, we're going to introduce them to the world. It's like, I think the world already knows who Annette is, you know. Anyway.
It was a month-long publicity campaign. Okay, so they're doing a circus.
Okay.
Over by where It's a Small World is.
Yeah, opens November 24th, 1955, which, by the way, was Thanksgiving Day. And it features act like George Keller and his 30 Savage Cats, which... according to longtime Disneyland employees that I've interviewed, it's this really sort of, you know, mangy looking group of lions, tigers, and leopards that are so heavily drugged that, you know, the only real danger that they posed to the public was if they fell asleep on their perch and then fell over on Mr. Keller, you know. You know, but he'd bring them out there and, you know, try to get them to stand up. But anyway, because this was supposed to be Disneyland's big holiday thing, they sort of shoehorned in a finale where it's March of the Toys. And so it's Christmas-themed grand finale, and so you've got your Mouseketeers along with Jimmy Dodd.
Jimmy Dodd?
Jimmy Dodd was the Mouseketeer. I mean, when you see the show, he's the adult, you know, who, you know, see you real soon. But he actually came out and served as the ringmaster for this thing.
Wow.
But two shows a day, you know, so.
Wow.
So anyway, he and the Mouseketeers join some costume Disney characters. They dance around this magical growing Christmas tree, which I guess somebody who had, you know, seen the Nutcracker had borrowed the idea from.
Sure.
And then as it ends, Santa comes in on his sleigh. All right. And that's supposed to be the big finale of the show. And at the first performance, they hadn't really rehearsed. Santa, I guess, ran into the center pole of the tent and damn near brought down all of the cats.
The big cats are running everywhere.
You know, it's like, all right, you know, so it really wasn't what they envisioned. In fact, what threw them off from day one is that nobody came. I mean, it had very, very low attendance for the show. And it turns out it was really more a case of the pricing that you, in that day at Disneyland, what you did is you paid a $1 entrance fee,
right,
and then you bought tickets for each individual attraction that you went on. And in this case, it was a $1 fee to go in to see the circus. And a lot of parents just, you know, walked all the way back, looked at the circus tent, and saw what the fee was. And it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. So the show only ran 6 weeks. It shut down January 6th of 56, I believe.
So it ran all through Christmas. That was their Christmas entertainment, the circus.
That was their Christmas entertainment. Now, don't get me wrong. They did it wasn't the only Christmas-themed entertainment in the park. The Jim Corcus tells this great story about how the first Christmas carolers at the Happiest Place on Earth, who turned out were 12 music students from the University of Southern California who would dress up as Dickens characters and wander around performing.
Were they hired or they were just showing up?
Well, no, that was
formal day, Dapper Day.
That was kind of the interesting aspect of this. What they did is that there was Dr. Charles Hurt. He was a director of music at UCLA. Uh-huh. And as it turns out, he was a good, close, personal friend of Walt Disney. And, you know, Walt really leaned heavily on this guy during the first 4 or 5 years when it came. Because, again, Disneyland didn't have an entertainment department at this point. And it was like, it's Christmas, what am I going to do? And Charles was like, well, let me grab some of my students, and brought 12 of them down, and they raided the costume department of the studio, and so they had these Dickens Christmas carolers, you know, work in the park. But this was also during the period where they couldn't quite decide what to do with the bandstand for Disneyland. I mean, it used to be in down at City Hall Plaza. And in fact, what they found is it blocked the view of the castle as people entered the park. So they then, for a while, they actually moved it all the way out to basically the corner of Frontierland and Adventureland. So,
sure, bandstand. So what the British would have done when they were colonizing Africa. Sure.
Well, but this is the thing that I particularly enjoy about it, especially when you understand that, you know, this is the year that they've launched Jingle Cruise at, you know, both Disneyland and Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom. It's like, but even back then, people who were riding the Jungle Cruise and looking at the, you know, the lions and the tigers could still hear vaguely in the distance Silent Night. You know, what's going on? You know, but yeah, these 12 kids came out and performed, and you know, and the interesting thing is that component was so successful. By 1956, what they did is, at this point, they'd actually moved the bandstand back over by the castle. In fact, it ended up pretty much in a place where the Carnation Plaza, where that new Fantasyland extension has been built.
Right.
And they strung up some lights, and this area then became known as the Disneyland Christmas Bowl. And you could go there and watch the Dickens carolers sing. They'd bring in the Disneyland band would stand there and, you know, perform holiday music. And they also, again, began bringing in local high school groups and college choirs who also performed holiday music. And what's kind of interesting about that, and again, this is Dr. Charles Hurt, again, who put the idea together. He noticed how the crowds were reacting to these choirs, and if he brought multiple choirs together, they'd get even bigger crowds. And he was the guy who was like, why don't we do a massed event? Why don't we do something of size and see if that works? And Walt gave him the go-ahead.
What year is this?
This is 56, 57. Okay. And in 58, he finally gets, you know, the go-ahead for the very first candlelight procession. And
1958. That long ago.
That long ago.
Wow.
So, yeah, okay. We are coming up on for Disneyland. What is that? That's the
55 years.
55 years. So,
wow.
But yeah, the first group was the first time around. It was 16 choirs together moving down Main Street to the plaza, and what was kind of again would have been a kind of an interesting visual while they're singing. The members of Hurt's Dickens choir are actually standing on Sleeping Beauty Castle, up on the balcony they're performing.
I thought you were going to say the parade is coming the other way, because that would have been that would have been equally interesting. But okay, your thing was worse too. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, but you know, just that they were trying. They really were trying. But you know, it just every year it was sort of like, because again, nobody had ever done this. It's like, well, what are we going to do next? And in regard to the Christmas parade, which is now a Disneyland tradition, that really, if you're hung up on details, yes, there was a parade, a parade in 55, but it was a circus parade, and
the circus parade with Santa Claus.
That's it, exactly. Sort of tacked on. It was okay. It wasn't the really first holiday parade at the park. Didn't happen till 55, and even then, it was one of these things where it's Christmas in many lands. I mean, there's a name that just says magic, doesn't it, Len?
Wait, what year?
This is December of 57.
Christmas in many lands.
Christmas in many lands. And again, why it was called Christmas in many lands was that Disneyland would reach out to, you know, you know, the Sons of Norway, or, you know, the
in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles branch of the Sons of Norway. Okay,
that's right. Exactly. Or, the deal was, look, come to Disneyland, march in our parade, you know, perform a Christmas song, and we'll give you free admission to the park and free tickets. And, you know, that's how they padded out their parades. It's just that all these groups, well, sure, I'll come and perform at Disneyland. Sure, I'll march in the parade. But yeah, it's just because, again, you had this fledgling entertainment department that really didn't know what to do.
So what were the many lands that were celebrating Christmas? Talking about like Wisconsin or what?
That's right. Cheese, holiday cheese grommet. No, I've seen a listing of this, and what's kind of interesting is that if you want a real sense of how this was done, go on YouTube right now. There is actually, the grand opening of the Matterhorn television special from 1959, and they have an opening special, and basically all the groups that are marching in this parade are the very same groups that have been tapped for Christmas of 58. You know, so it's like, you know, this is, you know, Swiss Bell Ringers and some Norwegian dance troops, and it's this fascinating mix of cultures that, again, you have to understand that Disneyland at that point, there was no place on the earth, you know, entertainment-wise that was hotter. If somebody said, hey, you want to come perform at Disneyland, you know, and we'll give you tickets for the attractions to enjoy afterwards.
Oh, my God, you're right, it is.
I'm
looking at the YouTube video.
Yeah. So, but seriously, you have to go check this out, folks. It's just, you can watch the parade and get a sense of, and more to the point, Len, look at how homemade. This is not, you know, these aren't.
Yeah, this looks like stuff that you and I could do with a quick trip to Michael's and $1,000.
That's it, exactly.
that's some interesting. It looks like the floats are built on baby carriage parade. Wow, that's interesting. Huh, how about
much,
that?
Pretty much. So, But now to give you some idea of the progression of Christmas at Disneyland, starting in 58 was the first time you started to see significant decorating in the park. I mean, not just individual wreaths on doors and things like that. This is the first time they strung garland across the street with lights on Main Street USA. But again, Walt was kind of a stickler about Christmas. He was one of these guys who really wanted to celebrate Christmas around Christmas. So decorations went up 2 weeks before December 25th and came down on January 2nd. And just as long as Walt was calling the shots, that's what happened.
That was
so. Meanwhile, in regard to the official Disneyland tree.
There's an official Disneyland tree?
Yeah, that started Town Square, I want to say 56, 57. It was definitely there by 58, and at this point it's 20 feet tall, but again, it's one of these things where it's like, there's not a design shop that's making individual ornaments. They had gone out, you know, locally and just bought boxes of ornaments and hung them up on the tree. But the other thing, and what's kind of interesting is you do Google or you know, do some investigation of Disneyland Christmas 1950s, 1960s.
So real quick, the reference video you want is titled on YouTube is Holiday Time at Disneyland 1962.
There we go.
45 minutes. It's actually so I guess they did a World of Color.
There were two of them. In fact, another one folks want to reference is – I think it's called Holiday Time at Disneyland. In fact, what's kind of ironic about that one, Seasons?
No, Holiday Time at Disneyland, 1962, yeah.
But there's actually another one, in 66, Lynn. I think it's called Disneyland Around the Seasons, 1966. And in fact, what's kind of ironic about that one is, again, 66. This is Walt.
Oh, you're right. You know, 66.
Just before he passed away. But that we'll get to that one a little bit here. Anyway, so we have our Christmas trees. In fact, if you want to get a sense of what Disneyland looked like, in fact, I can't recommend this enough the next time you're actually out to the Disneyland Resort. Go over to the Disneyland Hotel. In fact, What you want to do is take the escalator next to Goofy's kitchen and go upstairs. Mm-hmm. And there's a series of function rooms up in that area. But and be good. Don't wander into any of these, you know, these meetings or that setting. But outside in the hallway are these amazing pieces of concept art that have just, you know, these giant canvases of, you know, early Matterhorn, early Big Thunder Mountain. But one of the paintings there is an early concept of what the Disneyland Castle would look like at Christmas. Mm. And they have – but again, it's a very late 1950s, early 1960s. So these are white metallic Christmas trees stuck in the middle of the lagoon.
That's the way God intended – God intended Christmas trees to be aluminum, Jim. As the owner of a mid-century modern house, let me tell you how Christmas trees should look.
Well, there you go. But picture them stuck in the middle of lagoon, all right, with lights that would rotate from pink to
a color wheel. Yeah. I think that's absolutely perfect.
Well, I am glad to hear that because that's what it was like, and they have this beautiful painting up there.
It's
on that
California.
Floor.
It's what.
There you go. Oh, but speaking of giant lit up Christmas trees, we have to talk about the Matterhorn, which, again, opened in July of 59. Okay. And by 1960, 61 or thereabouts, what Disneyland used to do to celebrate the holiday season is they bring a giant crane in, mm-hmm, and hoist at the top of the Matterhorn a 20-foot-tall rotating Christmas star that lit up at night.
Wow.
In fact, again, you know, if you want to Google this and do Matterhorn Christmas Star, there is one of the most horrifying photographs in the history of man. Basically, it's a black and white photograph of the star being winched into place at the top of the Matterhorn. And Santa is standing at the top of the Matterhorn, sort of waving it in. But if you look closely at the photograph, Santa is standing at the top of the most rickety wooden ladder you've ever seen in your entire life. So it's
I'm seeing it. My toes are curling. Oh, dear God. Wow, so, you can see the orange groves.
This gives you some idea of what Anaheim was like back in the day. But think about it. This guy is
literally standing on a ladder on the top of the Matterhorn.
That's right. That's right. So the photos that followed this of Santa tumbling to his death,
Santa's just sleeping, kids.
Yeah. But again, I'm thinking this was probably done on a Monday or Tuesday. So, what was really cool about this is that they put the star into place. And then what they do on the nights around Christmas is, again, you've got this giant lit up star, but they're throwing green spotlights on the Matterhorn. So in effect, the Matterhorn has become Orange County's Christmas tree for that. In fact, if you talk to a lot of baby boomers from that period, they will tell you, you know, memories of being in the back of the family station wagon, zooming along the five, and there's this giant Christmas tree at Disneyland. So, what do you think about it compared to what they do to that? That was low tech, but sounds charming. You know, just sort of like, you know, how cool that must have been. But all right. So anyway, we're jumping ahead into the 60s here.
All right.
And we have to go back to Christmas of Many Lands Parade for a little bit, because it took a really interesting turn in December of 61. This was the year that Disney's version of Babes in Toyland opened in theaters. And as a really kind of clever, you know, bit of cross promotion, coupled with the fact that, you know, just, you know, these things are just sitting around a warehouse in the studio. I got to do something with them. Walt had all the oversized toys that had been built for Tom Tom's Battle with Barnaby. Mm-hmm. He had them folded into that year's parade. And while this Annette Funicello, Tommy Sands movie wasn't the hit that Walt was hoping for, the oversized toys sure were. And which is why Walt turned to Bill Justice, who, along with Exotencio, another Disney legend, these are the guys who did the stop motion sequence in that movie, who designed a lot of the toys and then hand animated it. And Walt turned to Bill and said, you know, is there a way we could create a walking, you know, a version of the Tin Soldier costume that people could wear in the park and walk around in? And so Bill, you know, created that for the 62 version of the parade, which such a hit Walt just turns around and just tells Billy, you're it. You're the guy who designs the parades. You're the guy who designs the walk-around costumes for the park now. And the full-size version of his parade, which, again, if you watch that TV special on YouTube that Len and I were just talking about, Disneyland Around the Seasons, they have the full 1964 Fantasy on Parade, which features all of Bill's weird character costumes. You've got, you know, things like stuff you'd never be able to get away with at Disneyland today. For example, there's a two-person camel, you know, that walks through the park, but it's also led by the most offensive, you know, creation of a person from the Middle East that you could possibly imagine.
Sure.
You know.
Oh, God.
You know, it's just our 1960s take on, you know, how to do these sorts of things. But the other thing that premiered with this parade is the silly reindeer that people used to love so much about the Disneyland, you know, parade that got replaced recently by, I guess, more anatomically correct reindeer. Before we step away from Babes in Toyland, we have to I got to tell one of my favorite stories about history of the park. That you got to understand that the Main Street Opera House, now the home of the Walt Disney Story and the great moments with Mr. Lincoln,
sure,
wasn't open to the public from July of 55 till November of 61. Mostly because this was actually the park's carpenter shop. If anything that was built at Disneyland, if you wooden railings for the Golden Horseshoe Review or, you know, stairs or, you know, anything got built there.
Really?
Yeah. So anyway, what with Babes in Toyland being the most expensive movie that the studio had produced up until that time, it was just a budget busting $3 million, Len. Oh, my God.
$3 million.
Yes. That's pretty much the Danish budget for, you know, My Magic Express. But we'll get back to that. You want coffee? Anyway, well, Walt was determined to make the most of what he'd spent. So, and since the props, they had an exhibit over in Tomorrowland that literally had been thrown into that part of the park at the last minute in 55 of the, basically, you know, props and costumes for 20,000 Leagues. And they even brought the rubber squid in.
Wow.
And that was this huge hit. And so Walt's like, well, hell, that worked. So, and we got this empty building. So it's like, we're going to send the sets from Babes in Toyland over to Disneyland and set them up. And now I know at the Disney parks now, when you look at something like The Legend of Jack Sparrow or, this sort of thing of bringing movie props in for people or sets to walk through is kind of, you know, a cliche. But this was really different, something interesting in 61. Though what was kind of ironic is that when the movie opened on December 14th, 61, mm-hmm. it really was not well received. In fact, a lot of the critics complained that it looked like Walt had shot it at Disneyland. You know, just this sort of really sugary mess. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is that They basically broke it up into three lanes. And if you've seen the movie, you know, they did one room was Mother Goose Land and the end was the toy factory in Toyland. But in the middle was the Forest of No Return. Have you ever seen this movie, Len?
No.
Oh, you have to at least for this number, because they have these giant rubber trees that, these really menacing, awful-looking rubber trees that sing and dance the Force of No Return song.
It sounds scary.
It is. All right. But what was great about this room is that they brought six of these costumes in.
Okay.
But what the kids didn't realize is, you know, so you walk in, you look at the cat costumes, what you realize is there's a cast member in one of them. So, you know, so you wait for the children to walk in the room and sort of eyeball things, wait till they turn their back, and then the tree steps off the platform and goes out after the child. Then it was like, evidently they began selling, you know, pants.
Undergarments.
There we go. Just because of the number of children who were frightened by the walking tree.
Oh, but,
that was only open from December 17th, 61, through September 30th of 63. At that point, Set up as a placeholder. The Mickey Mouse Club had sort of a place where you could go and, you know, sign up for the club or, you know, see memorabilia, that sort of thing, till July of 64. And then they shut it down, and then it becomes home for Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. But anyway, but during this period, Disneyland really is coming into its own when it comes to the holidays. They've got a design package in place for virtually every part of the park. In fact, one of the cleverest ideas is you'd come up to the hub, and here's the house of the future again.
Yep.
Big plastic house. Only to make it look like it's a Christmas package, they had a giant 10-foot red bow on the top and, you know, huge ribbons that ran down the side. And, you know, they had started putting garlands around other parts of the park, you know, the out by the Golden Horseshoe and all that. And it was really, you know, Disneyland, going to Disneyland really at the holidays really became something to do. You know, and people were so looking forward to what was going to happen next when it's suddenly December of 66 and we lose Walt Disney. And this, you know, it was a very strange holiday season because obviously people turned out. But, you know, you had a lot of employees who were still trying to wrap their heads around, well, what happens to a Walt Disney Productions or a Walt Disney Company when there is no Walt Disney?
And
that's a story we'll get to in part two of our Christmas at the Disney theme parks.
That's right. We're only through about 10 years of our 50-year journey.
Yep. So, okay. So go get some Christmas cookies, folks. This is going to catch you.
That's fantastic, Jim. I'm looking forward to the other episodes. All right. For Jim Hill, this is Len Testa. You've been listening to part one of our Christmas special about Walt Disney and Disneyland and Christmas. Please rate us on iTunes and let us know what else you'd like us to talk about, especially as the new year starts. Jim and I are looking for more adventures in 2014. For Jim, this is Len. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next show.
Happy holidays, folks.